his room. Thank you very, very much. I'd like to first of all say the shiur will be for the Aliyah of the Neshama of Miriam Nana John Bat Yitzchak. Thank you very much for opening your home, Ms. Gramazian. And you know, I live in Muncie, and in Muncie, we got a lot of Jews. You're aware of that. It's very Jewy. So I'm driving here this evening, and I pass the one non-Jew, because everyone needs a token non-Jew in the area. And I'm driving past this house, and this non-Jew is surrounded by Jews. And I've seen him as a nice guy. We schmooze a couple of times. So he decorates his garden for Christmas. And he doesn't just put up, you know, inflatable, you know, Santa, you know what I'm saying, or one tree. This guy is literally sucking all the energy out of Muncie in order to light up his garden. There is so much stuff going on. And every year it gets more and more and more. He is like the Haredi Christian. You know what I'm saying? Is there such a thing? The entire front garden, you drive past, you can't see. It gets into your eyes, it burns your eyeballs. And he's got moving Santas. He's got the reindeer moving along. He's got the lights. The trees are like on fire. It must cost him like 50 grand just to light up his front yard. And he must be saying, this is what we do. And I thought to myself, Hanukkah's coming. And we Jews, what do? We take a little light and we light it up and we put it in the window. And we're the religious ones. That's it. We can't do any better.
I tell you a secret, Rabbi. It's not a non-Jew. It's just trying to keep the mishalach out.
Nice one, Sid. Keep all the guys. That's right. Very good. He wants to keep the goy, the charity collectors out. Could you leave the jokes to me, Sid? Could you just one night? Could you just?
I could use that.
That's good. That's good. That's good. Yeah. Actually, his name is Shmuel, and he wears a yarmulke. Now you mentioned it, it makes sense, really. Now I'm thinking about it. So there we are, and I'm like, well, we can't do better. One little candle. Like, let's put at least. Let's put 30 candles of vodka. Let's make a madura. And why in the window? Why do we put our candle in the window? Tell me. Pesach comes. Do you walk up to the window, pick up the matzah, and you sit at the window munching on your matzah? Do you do such a thing? Do you say, oh, everyone's going to see me eating. It's matzah. It's Pesach. All the kids, get to the window with your mawa, but we don't want to get over there. Get over the window. Munch. No, you don't do that. You walk around on Sukkot with your lulav and esrog in the streets, like, hey, well, unless you're Lubavitch. But, I mean, most of us, we don't walk around shaking the lulav, and in the window, everyone can see it. Suddenly comes on Hanukkah, this, quote-unquote, rabbinic chag, and there we are in the window. We're not doing mishloach manot in the window. We're not reading the Megillah in the window. Suddenly comes along Hanukkah, and there we are, dafka, in their faces, in the window, lighting our little light. Very unusual. It's just not like us. We're usually more tznua, right? We love mitzvah, but we're not so much in people's faces. Why are we doing this? And we specifically, dafka, we do it specifically for people to see it. So just when it gets dark, people on the streets, we want it to be just then. Very unusual. What is this all about? So in order to answer this question, a few more, let's take a little journey together. Let's go back a couple of thousand years, actually more than that, to the time of one of the greatest military leaders that probably ever existed in history. And, you know, since Hanukkah is coming in a few days, obviously in our heads we're reading stuff and I'm always learning something new. And let's talk about Alexander the Great. And whatever he was, if you have the name The Great, right, put after your name, you did something right. If you're called the Tzaddik like Yosef, you must be good. If you're the Russia like Bilam, you must be really bad. Right, so let's make sure that the names that are added onto our names are good and not bad. Because there are some good names and there are some bad names. Alexander the Great was an incredible military leader. He, at the age of 20 years old, went out to conquer a massive part of the world, Asia, the Middle East, parts of North Africa, and eventually ended up in Eretz Yisrael. And the Gemara in Yoma tells us that he actually arrived there and he wanted to destroy the Beit HaMikdash. He was a conqueror, that's what he did. And he encamped, as the Gemara, fascinating Gemara in Yoma, he encamped preparing for this, and the Samaritans, right, they're referred to as the Good Samaritans, let me be very clear, they were bad, right, the Kutin, they were bad people, and they were saying that these Jews are rebelling against you, and you should destroy their temple, the Beit HaMikdash. And Shimon HaTzadik, who was the last part, the remainder of the Anshei Kazak HaGadola, of the men of the Great Assembly, he realized he had to do something
Because this conqueror was going to come and squish the Beit HaMikdash,
the second Beit HaMikdash that had been built. He got dressed up in his big day kahuna, and he went out to go to the camp. And he came from one side, and the Samaritans came from the other side. And they met up, and Shimon HaTzadik stood before Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great jumps off his chariot and bows down. Now, Alexander the Great bowed down to anyone, and he's walking around the world with thousands, tens of thousands of troops. They see him bow down. They're like, what are you doing? Why are you bowing down? And what does he say? He says, you know, every time I go to battle, I see a face in front of me. And whenever I see that face, I know I'm going to win. And he looked at Shimon HaTzadik and said, that's the face. This is the guy. And he said, I don't believe these Jews want to destroy me. I don't believe they're going to rebel against me. They're good people. And he had a good relationship with Shimon HaTzadik. And we know the custom, actually for that one year, every newborn baby boy was given the name Alexander, which is why among the Jewish people we say the name Alex, Alexander, or Sender. You ever seen Sender?
Iskander, my brother. Alexander, Iskander.
I didn't realize that.
He's not here.
Wow.
He's not here.
Don't worry, I'm recording it. You can send it to him. I'll upload it. Don't worry. He'll listen. Wow, there you go. It goes right back. I thought it was Persian, not Greek. Okay. So this name definitely has passed through. I have actually family as well. There's actually a Hadjioff, actually, with the name Alex at the beginning. My cousin, my father's cousin as well. So he rules. Unfortunately, he gets a terrible disease. He dies at the age of 32, 33. When he dies, what happens? The generals take over. This is always the way it works. And his empire gets divided into three sections. Listen very carefully. Into three sections. One of those three sections is called the Seleucid, and that was Syrian Greek. Syrian Greeks was one side. The other was the Ptolemy, and that was Egyptian Greece. And the last one was Macedonia, that's real Greece, with Sparta, Athens, and that's where that was going on. And they had wars among themselves. Eventually, Israel moved from the Egyptian Greece ownership to the other ownership of the Syrian Greeks. And Syrian Greeks took over Israel. And at first, things were good, actually, for quite a while. Over 100 years, the status quo was there. The Jews were doing their thing, and the Greeks were doing their thing. And never to mention me, and the Jews were fascinated by the Greeks, because the Greeks were very, very smart people. We had the world of Aristotle, they had a Plato, we had Socrates. The Jews enjoyed it. Actually, the Greek language, you know, from Yefet, Yafet, beautiful. It's a very beautiful language. One of the only other languages, I believe, you're allowed to actually write the Torah in, is Greek. So Greek always had a great impact, and we were fascinated by them, and they appreciated the Jews, but they wanted to change us. They wanted to change us. How? They wanted to inform us. Like, you Jews, what are you doing? Right? You believe in this invisible God? Join us! We got loads of gods, small g. We got loads of them! So the Jews had a bit of a problem with that. Right? And by the way, their view of God is very different to our view, obviously. Their gods in mythical writings, they were up on, you know, Mount Olympus. They were drinking with the guys, and they were hanging out, and they were having relationships. Very different. They would make fun of their gods. Their gods were put down. And secondary to humans, the whole Hellenistic, if I could just summarize everything I've read over the years, what I think is all of Hellenism, which is really the Greek thought process, is one thing. And everything comes out from that. And that is, it's all about the humans. Humans are the best. Nothing beats us. Not even gods can beat us. We look good. We run well, the whole Olympics, right? The original, just the thought of this, by the way, is nauseating. But the original Olympics was performed naked. That's the way it was. It was all about, I mean, ironically, the Jews were against that, obviously. And our Olympics are called the Maccabee Games. A little bit ironic with that. But we'll leave that aside for just one moment. So that's what they were doing. And then we'd go to the bathroom. They would have bathrooms in the public square because we're human. This is who we are. We're beautiful. We don't need to change. And the Hellenistic world was egocentric about us, and the Jewish world was theocentric. God is at the center. But besides that, we were doing well. Besides that, we had a good relationship, and we could actually understand and appreciate the beauty and the understanding that came with it. But besides this whole God thing, which is a major problem, obviously, because we had the idea of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Echad,
there were two other problems which we had with Greek culture. And the first one was, unfortunately, infanticide, which means killing babies. Now, they didn't say, go kill your babies. Hey, we hate babies. That wasn't their way of thinking. Their way of thinking is Aristotle wrote, and I'll read you a little bit of Aristotle. He says, there must be a law, and this is going to sound very familiar to you, that no imperfect or maimed child shall be brought up. And to avoid an excess in population, some children must be exposed. They would do that. They would leave children out in jars at nighttime. And for us, the Jewish people, this is abhorrent. For us, this was craziness. We wouldn't do such a thing. No matter how bad, heaven forbid, a child is. They didn't say, I like to kill babies. That's not what Aristotle was writing. He was like, population control. It makes sense. It was cold. It was rational. But it was true. Right? We don't need them. That's going to drain the resources. We know where this line of thinking ends up. We saw very clearly through the centuries until you get to 1939 to 1945. We just don't need them. They have no purpose. It starts here. This is where that whole Western culture idea, which we've seen over the years, end up. That was one problem. Another problem was, it's uncomfortable to say, but they were into paedophilia. And Plato himself, I have the quote here, I don't need to quote it for you, you can take my word for it. Plato himself wrote about this idea that children are there for enjoyment. Right? So we Jews were like, could not understand or accept this. And for them, the physical form was perfect. Obviously, one of the biggest problems they had with us was Brit Milah. The concept that you're going to take the child, this baby, and mutilate its body, take it away from its perfect physical form, they could not handle that. So they had problems, and they had differences, but for a long time, things were going very, very well. And then something happened. What happened was, someone called Antiochus III came along, and he started to see that Israel was a strategic point. And he started to see that these Jews, you know, how does it always work? It always starts the same way. First of all, they're nice to us, you see, because they want us to come to the country, because we Jews bring a lot of goodness, a lot of business know-how. We take care of them. And then they try to coax us into their way of thinking, into their way of life, right? And we don't go with that, because we're Jews. We do our own thing. And then they start to try to force us to do it, and for the most of us, still don't do it, and then they kill us. It starts with Antiochus III, and then Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, he's the main one we talk about when the kids come home, talking of King Antiochus. He was the one who was in charge of the Syrian Greeks, and he was like, we cannot take these Jews anymore. We've tried to be nice for over 100 years. They haven't listened to us, and I'm in charge now, and now we've got to start to force them to follow us. And see, for the Greeks, anything which was beautiful is holy. For us, it's the exact opposite. Anything that was holy is beautiful. That's really the difference between us and them. The idea of beauty, of form, was what they were obsessed with. Antiochus could not take it. These Jews aren't changing. Now, when I was a kid, and we used to hear these stories, we used to the plays, so we thought there were two sides. It was the Greeks, right? The Yavanim, right? Yavan, Yud, Vav, Nun. Okay? And we're told you can read it the other way, which is Nun, Vav, Yud, Noi, beauty. And we thought it was just them against us. But when you get older, you start to realize that it ain't so simple. Because the Jews weren't just fighting the Greeks, and the Greeks weren't fighting the Jews. The Greeks were fighting each other. The Jews were fighting the Greeks. And the worst part, and this part is going to resonate with you, because this story happened thousands of years ago. We are still living this every single day. It's Jews fighting other Jews. There were Jews who loved the Hellenized way of thinking. The intellectual Jew. The Jew that, oh, this is so beautiful. You know, let's make it part of Judaism. And let's inculcate it. Let's make it part of who we are. And let's study this whole Greek thing. And together with Judaism, we'll marry together. But what happens is, and all of you know this so clearly, what happens eventually is you start to push away the Judaism, and it's all Hellenization. And then the Jews themselves were fighting and fighting. There was an ideological war, and it ended up becoming a physical war. It was Jew against Greek. It was Jew against Jew-Greek. Greek-Jew. It was a whole mix-up. It wasn't so simple. Let me tell you one of the worst parts of this, which I read. Beryl Wine wrote this very nicely in one of his books I was reading. And he says like this. He says that there were two scholars, Tzadok and Bisus. Tzadok and Bisus. Both these people were against the oral Torah. Torah Shebaal Peh. It was all Torah Bichtav. Right, eventually we have the Karaites, right? Karaites, Karaim, right? Karah, they just follow the Karah, the Pasukim in the Torah, okay? But it started with the Tzedukim, with the Sadducees, and they were against the oral Torah. Now, there's no doubt about it that they were influenced by the Hellenization that led them to this. They wanted the written word, not the oral Torah, you don't see it. They wanted the written word. So they were definitely, must have been influenced by what was happening around them and the Greek lifestyle that they were surrounded by because they're in control of Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim. There's no doubt about it. But when the Jews started to fight back, as we're going to see in a couple of moments, you know what? These Jews, the Sadducees, they're the ones who perfectly married together with the Hellenists. It worked out perfectly. It was the great Shidduch. And we had, and it's hard to believe this, but we had Jews fighting other Jews and taking the side of the enemy. And by the way, it didn't start as a physical war. It started as an... Actually, this story, by the way, it's going to blow your mind, is the first ever ideological religious war in world history. I believe that to be true. This is the first ever ideological... We've had many since then. It started here. And it was a good one. And it was worth fighting. Because without us fighting it, it would never happen. And by the way, this is a galut. You know, we have four galuts in Jewish history. This one is the galut of Yavan, of Greece. And we're in Israel. The action takes place in Israel. Galut, exile, doesn't mean we've been kicked out and we're fighting elsewhere. We were having this fight, this ideological and then physical battle in Eretz Yisrael. This is where the action was taking place. And that's what they were dealing with. So Antioch, so what do they do, first of all? When they try to bring the Jews back and try to persuade them, what do they... First, they're nice to us, but we've passed that. That didn't work. They try to force us. So what do they try to do when they try to force us in order to become like them? So they start to ban certain mitzvot. And the mitzvot they ban are the ones we know that keep us Jewish. In other words, they know what works. So what do they ban? First of all, the first thing they always start with is time. Time, what does that mean? Stop us following the calendar. Rosh Chodesh, gone. Forbidden to start operating and making movements, trying to figure out the moons. Remember how it used to work? They didn't have calendars. They didn't go to the local supermarket, right? They didn't have the, you know, Manischewitz Haggadah and all these other things. They didn't have the calendar that we're dealing with. They used to have bonfires that would pass from mountain to mountain. It was a perfect system, and it worked very well until the Sadukim didn't like it, and they started to make bonfires to mess it up. Right, that's where we ended up a whole two-day chag. It started from that. That was the problem. So the first thing to do is ban Rosh Chodesh. You ban Rosh Chodesh, all the holidays, gone. Okay, but you still have Shabbat, because Shabbat's not based upon the moon. It's a weekday activity. They ban Shabbat. Obviously, they're going to ban Brit Milah, right? That was a big one. If they want to get anything, they want to stop Brit Milah. You're taking this perfect, beautiful body and mutilating it? They didn't like that. They did not like that at all. That Brit Milah and that number 8 is going to have some significance when it comes to Hanukkah as well as part of the hit back we're going to give to the Greek world. Not that it exists anymore. You realize that. We the rabbis still walking around. There's no Greek scholars walking around. Right? There's no Aristotelians walking around. There's no Plato, no Socrates. Oh, hi, what are, me? I'm a Greek philosopher. You don't get that nowadays. Some weird guy, some university, you know, down south. Right? He's an expert in Greek classics. But that's it. You know what I'm saying? Right? We've seen who won the battle. But there are still reverberations that are going through history that we're still being subjected to this very, very day. So no Shabbat, and of course, kosher. Right? You've got to stop us eating. You want to annoy a Jew? Take away his kosher food. Right? Shechita and all forms of kashrut were banned by them as well. It was getting worse. Antiochus knew that we Jews don't like pigs. Right? Although there's more non-kosher creatures you can eat, right? But pigs was a big problem. And they started to take the Beit HaMikdash, they took it over, and they made the high priest, it's hard to even believe this, sacrifice a pig in the Beit HaMikdash. And then they would go from town to town, and they would enforce people to cut open pigs over holy books. Like this was a psychological weapon they were using against our people. Until they got to a town called Modi'in, which is in the west of Yerushalayim, it's still there. Baruch Hashem. And they got there, and the head of that town was a guy called Matisyahu. He was the elder of the town. Okay? He was a Kohen, and he was in the town. And he saw that one of these Sadducees was there, one of these Hellenized Jews was there, together with a Greek official, and they want him to bring a sacrifice, a korban, of a pig, of a chazir, in Modi'in. And he turned up, and the Hellenized Jew was ready to do it. What does he do? He kills the Jew, and then he kills the Greek official, and then what do? You run, because they're going to come for you, and they're going to kill you. And he goes up the mountains. And then the rebellion started. And it started small. And they were up in the mountains and they were building up. And he had his family. He had five sons that we know of. There was Yehuda, Yochanan, Shimon, Eleazar, and Yonatan. And these five boys, these five Kohanim, really were the main group. They were called the Maccabees. Isn't that a band? No, okay, fine. They're the Maccabees, right? Maccabee. Now, Maccabee actually means a hammer. They would smack down. That was what they were trying to achieve. They're from the tribe of family of Hashmonaim, of the Hasmoneans. But they were going to hammer down. It was hammer time. That's what I tell my students. Okay, only two people got that one. Right, in order to crush these people, in order to bring redemption to our people. The word Maccabee is Mem. It is Chaf, Bet, and Yud, and stands for Mi Kamcha Belem Hashem. Who is like you, O powerful Hashem? That's what they were about. They were zealots. You know, I must tell you something. I hope you appreciate this. If the Hanukkah story happened today, I mean, all these Jews are like lighting menorahs in their windows, and it's a good thing. All right, if they're not so religious, they're doing the bulb thing. You know, the blue bulb. You get this in this area. You know, the bulb menorahs they put in the windows. Right, screwing the little bulbs in, you know. If most of these Jews knew what the fight was really about, they'd be on the side of the Greeks. I would say the majority of the Jewish people who celebrate Hanukkah, oh, with a little bit of dreidel, we hand out some gelt to the grandkids, we put the electric menorah in the window. If they knew what this story was really all about, they'd be like, are you crazy? I'm with the Greeks on this one. This was a small group that brought redemption to the Jewish people against other Jews who were very much against this Jewish religious minority who were trying to save their religion in Eretz Yisrael. Sounds slightly familiar. That's exactly what this battle was. That's what the Galut was all about. And they wanted to bring it in. Now, you know, you read the story and you read through the Maccabees, the book of Maccabees, which is a book that's written later on in Hebrew and then that's Maccabees 1 at least, which is a story, and it wasn't added to the Tanakh, because it was after Tanakh was closed, right? But this is the book we go to. You read through it, you think it happened, chick-chuck, right? 1, 2, 3 weeks, finally, what, for 25 years this happened. Well, that's like the Purim story, right? We read it, it's like, oh, it's a two-week story. It takes like a half hour to read it. How long could it have taken? 25 years of going on. Within the third year of the 25 years, within the third year of the 25 years, something happened. This group grew into a large group of 12,000. The Greek Syrian army must have been at least 40,000 people at that point. And what do? They wanted to make a point. They wanted to recapture Yerushalayim, the holy city, and go back into the temple. Now, the temple at that point was a gymnasium, right? Who knows what they were doing in there? They made it to a hall. The whole temple was used for non-religious reasons, non-Jewish reasons, idol worship. They wanted to capture it. One, to beat the Greeks, Syrian Greeks, and two, to make a point. So they went in, and the rest of the story, you know, the few beat the many. They fought them off. That's one of the two miracles we talk about. But funny, we make less of a story about that, although in the Maccabees, in the book of Maccabees, that's actually the story that's spoken about. The oil is not mentioned over there, but the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat does talk about the other miracle, which was the miracle of the oil, of course. They went in, and everything was defiled. Actually, the menorah didn't exist at that point. The menorah actually melted down, right, because it was made of pure gold, and sold off. Right? So they wanted to light anything at that point in order to make this point. You know, the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash would light out over all of Eretz Yisrael. It was up on a mountain, right? First on Yerushalayim, then on a mountain, and then in the Beit HaMikdash. And the windows were set up inside the Beit HaMikdash that you could see. Usually it was set up to capture the outside light to bring it in. But the Beit HaMikdash, the windows were reversed. It would be set up so the light from inside would go out. So everyone could see the menorah. They wanted to make a point. It was a political, ideological point they were trying to make. And so they wanted to find oil. It was all defiled. You know what happened. Your kids have told you the story 1,000 times. They found one small jar of oil, which was enough to last for one day, ended up lasting for 8 days. And for 8 days, they celebrated. This was a very happy, special time for this small band of people that had grown to thousands at this point. Why do we make such a big deal out of the oil and less of a deal about the fight, the physical fight? And this is interesting. And I believe the answer is going to be like this. Every chag we have comes, and the mitzvot come to mirror what was going on. You see, on Purim, they wanted to physically kill us. And so we celebrate Purim by eating and drinking and singing and having a physical good time. On Hanukkah, the fight came later on when they really got upset with us. But what they really wanted to do was to change us, to make us lose our Judaism. So what's the way we celebrate? We fight the spiritual battle with light. So the oil miracle was probably not as great as, I don't know, a few people being a lot of people, you know? A few small band of raggedy Jews, right, were beating off this big Syrian army that had come through, the Greek Syrian army. That was probably a bigger, if not on par. But we kind of pushed that aside. We mentioned it. We kind of pushed that aside. We want to focus on the oil business. The oil's what it's all about, because the oil's going to represent who we are. So I want to talk for the few minutes we have left on the number 8. Now, I spoke here, last time I was here Rosh Hashanah? When was I here? Yeah, Rosh Hashanah. We spoke about Shabbat. We spent the first Shabbat together, if you remember. And we spoke about the number 7. Remember we said that the number 7 is completion. It's the Shlemut of the week. So 7 is all about completing Olam Hazeh. You 6 days you work, and then for the 7th day, you rest. So that's Shlemut, that's completion in Olam Hazeh. That's 7. So what's 8? 8 is obviously going to be one above that, which is Olam Haba. The number 8 is always going to connote that which is above, Lamala Minderach HaTeva, above the natural order. Whenever you see the number 8, it's dealing with above. 7 is below, right? 7 colors of the rainbow, right? That's Noach, Sheva Mitzvah B'nei Noach. He had to deal with the rainbow. He's Olam Hazeh. 7 notes in a musical scale. You go one da 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 ba da da da. Right? There's always 7 notes. So what's 8? 8 is Olam Haba. They say in the future there's going to be an 8th note. The Gemara says an 8th note is going to be added. Another string is going to be added. We're going to get a new element, whether it's literal or metaphorical. I'm not sure. It could well be literal. 8 is always above. Now, follow. This is amazing. Let me just share this one idea with you, while I still have you. 8. Is just above. Nachon? You have 7 is Olam Hazeh, this world, right? Shabbat, rainbows, we said notes, right? Days of the week, 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, back to 1 again. 8 is that which connects Olam Hazeh to Olam Haba. This world to the next world. Let's take the word Shmona. The word Shmona, 8. And let's rearrange the letters. And what do we get? We get Mishnah. Mishnah is one thing. What's Mishnah? Mishnah is the first time we took, right, the Oral Torah and put it down. It was that movement from the written Torah, Bichtav, and Torah Shabbat Peh, and just with the two meet. And we rearrange the letters again, and you get Neshama. What's the Neshama? You have 5 Neshamot. 5 for the price of 1. That's a good deal, especially for a Persian. So we have 5 Neshamot. The middle one is Neshama, right? You have the Nefesh, right? You have the Ruach, Neshama, you have the Chaya, Yechida. So the middle one, the Neshama, is that interposition where I'm connecting that world to this world and they come together. Then you have Hashemen, the oil. What's the oil? The oil connects the petil, the wick, right? And the ner, the ore of the flame that comes from it. It's what connects it. Right? You can't just have a wick with no fire. There's no fire without a wick. You have to have an interposition. That bit that connects the two together, that's the shemen. That's what's pulling together. That brings out the fire. That brings down Olam Haba and brings up Olam Hazeh. And the two get to meet. And that's Shemana. Eight is going to do that. The eighth test of Arvavino, according to different countings, is the Brit Milah. And it happens on the eighth day. Here's a good devout Torah. You can say over. It's like Florida, right? This is eyes of our Torah. The connects it. Eight is when you take a child who's a normal baby and you say you're about to go and live another worldly existence, an existence of eight in Olam Hazeh. That figure eight is not a Jewish symbol, right? But it's interesting that it is actually the symbol for infinity. It can't be coincidence. We didn't create that, right? But the number eight does always connote that which is above the physical realm. So we're now saying that eight is taking us above. That's the point they wanted to make. Now, it did take 4 days to go down and crush the olives, to make new olive oil, and shove it back up to Yerushalayim, but it's no coincidence it took 8 days. Eight was the number they were saying. This is where we are, because you, the Greeks, are so into the physical, 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 and you deny anything which is, if they could see it, smell it, touch it, it was there. If you can't, we're not interested. And when the Jewish people say, this Olam Hazeh is a temporary world, it's a prozdor, it is a hallway, a corridor into Olam Haba. That's what we're living in. Shabbat is going to be the entryway, the gateway into that world of eight. And that's why Mashiach, the word Mashiach is Limshoach, to anoint. They would take olive oil and put it onto the king's head in the form of a crown. That's what Mashiach means. Right? And the same olive oil was used in the menorah. And that was the same oil they wanted to use in the Beit HaMikdash in order to make this point. So let's go back to our first question we started with a few minutes ago. And what's that? So why are we taking this little thing and putting it in the... First of all, why the window? Why the window? And that is because that's what they did to us. You're about the physical. You want everyone to see everything. If it's not, we can't see, we're uninterested. We could do the same thing as well. And we could take our mitzvot and say, Mida Kanega Mida, that's the way you want to operate. We, the Jews, can do the same thing. And we will go to the window. We're going to show you that this is what we do. We're not afraid. So the only chag, which I can think of, when we get in their faces, as it were, into the outside world, Jews and non-Jews and everyone else, is Hanukkah. Pisume Nisa. Let the world know what happened. Let them understand this miracle and that we are here. And by the way, when does Hanukkah appear? In the darkest time of the year. That little light we have taken with us for thousands of years through Jewish history. It's kept us going. Because that little nair represents the neshama of the Jew that we've had to somehow, miraculously, keep lit for thousands of years when everyone else is trying to extinguish us. But our flame still is lit. But why one little candle? Such a big miracle. Let's go to the front garden, right? And let's make a nice big menorah, a nice big bonfire, you know what I'm saying? And let's light it up. Nah. That much we don't do. You see, a flame is an interesting thing. It's a spiritual thing. It always goes up. But I can have a small flame, which I'm holding on to, and I can give you some of it, and I give you some, and I give you some, and my flame is not diminished. If I give all of you water, then I have less water. But I can give each and every one of you a little bit of it, but I'm not diminished. We like that. But I don't want to be in your face. You can't shine a light in someone's face and say, this is the way. We're not into that. We're not going to missionize. We're like, here's the light. If you want it, you can come and get it. If you want the Torah, if you want to know what we believe, what we do, it's there for you in the window. Everyone can see us. But you've got to come to the light in order to benefit from it. The light is there for you in order to come. And that's what the Jewish people have taken with us for thousands of years. That we have a special light mission in order to be, as the prophet Isaiah says, a light unto the nations. There's no coincidence. That is the metaphor that is used. That we have to try to bring light to those people. And one of the main missions that we have in this world is to stay strong in our faith. Because we are living in very, very, I think, fascinating times. And one day they'll look back at this era and they're not going to believe the decisions that many Jews were making against their own people. They'll be shocked. Just like we look back, how could he join the Greeks? That a Beit HaMikdash. It makes no sense. It's happening today. And it's very, very important that we hold on very tightly to the small group that we are. I've told this before, I'll say it again. The majority of the Jewish people are not Shomer Shabbat. Right? We are the in-group within the in-group, which we've got to hold on, but we have to share that light with other people. Because at this time, most Jews are doing the Hellenization that those Jews were doing. They are spreading and they are joining, quote unquote, the other side, if I can use that expression. So the key is that we have it. It's not enough to hold it ourselves. We have to share it. And I believe that is the reason we have a small candle, but we put it in the window to attract other people to that eternal Jewish light. I'm going to stop over there. Questions, thoughts, comments?
How come you can't use them there?
You know, it's interesting. Actually, it's funny, you probably could actually. There's a machlot in the Gemara. It says you could probably light one candle with another candle, actually.
No,
but we don't take the holy and we don't use it for the mundane. That's really the thing over there. We don't cheapen the light. We don't cheapen it by using it for the mundane. Technically speaking, you could probably, right, in the menorah, they used to go boop, 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 right, in order to keep it going. That's what you used to do, is have long wicks that will light one to the other. That probably is actually, according to the Gemara, probably okay with the no, we don't do it, right? En reshid lishu meshu el barotan bilvad. We just take the light and use it. We don't profane it by reading from it or diminishing from it, right? Which you can do with Shabbat candles, not too close, but you cannot do with Hanukkah candles. We don't want to cheapen the light. That light has to be kept pristine and perfect. Okay, thank you everyone for coming out. Bezrat Hashem, you should have a wonderful, warm, and lighted up Hanukkah, Bezrat Hashem.
What do you know about Israel?
Hmm?
What's happening in Israel? Any view?
That I've seen? I studied politics. Thank you, guys.
The whole point is that you're sharing. The light is to share.
Yes.